Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
Two more great stories today.
Indeed.
One is a mutual friend of ours, Tracy Williams, who's been designing gardens in the Louisville area for many years, really. She's taken this concept to new heights.
She has, in a really innovative way, too, because she's designed her own living wall technology, mm-hmm. quite frankly. I know that within the industry, there's been some consternation, perhaps we could say, in terms of the most popular way in which to create green walls. And a lot of people aren't happy with it, and ultimately, it doesn't look good, you know, after a couple of years. Plus, because they're soil-based, Bob, they're really, really heavy.
Right.
So Tracy's come up with using a medium that's a hydroponic medium, so she can create a green wall in a little bit of a different way. And she's been allowed to do just that down at the Green Building, which is a LEED-certified building here in downtown Louisville. So, you know, it fits in with the whole profile of the Green Building, having this green wall. So we're going to go find out what Tracy's done, what kind of innovative thinker she really is in terms of coming up with this stuff on her own.
As she admits, it's an experiment at this point.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really know 3 years from now, 5 years from now, where this is going to lead,
right.
but she's at the cutting edge of something
right.
that's really kind of fun.
And she's eliminated some of the problems that have existed with the other systems, so it'll be interesting to watch, and it's in our own hometown. So, yeah, we'll head down to the Green Building here in a little bit for a visit to see the vertical garden.
Yeah, and also, really, sometimes obsession can be a trade-off with the rest of your family. You know, I've known a lot of people who got involved heavily in something to their success, really, and their achievement, but a lot of ways, it's a trade-off in the family and their friends because they have to give up so much to reach this obsession.
Right, and that obsession in this case is to see every bird on earth. Author Dan Capel writes the story of his father, quite frankly, who you know, was obsessed with listing, and he saw probably, I think the estimate is over 7,000 species of birds over his lifetime. But Dan pens this fabulous story about, you know, his dad's experiences with it, his own experiences, family life. So, you know, really puts a human face on someone's obsession with listing.
Exactly.
It was one of my favorite books of the year, in fact. So definitely you want to stick around to hear to see every bird on
earth.
That's
part sad and part, you know, success and everything in between, really.
Exactly.
Pretty human.
Exactly. That's the beauty of the story.
Right.
So, Bob, what's going on in your garden?
I think the recent cold snap was a test of our Zone 6-7 thing, and you do wonder about that. We've been kind of freely planting crepe myrtles and buddleias, and I've got a Sciadopitus, and there's some southern-based junipers I've planted. And I wonder now, come spring, how they're going to do, given that recent January cold snap.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an experiment, and I keep waiting for the bad winter when we lose a lot of plants. And I've mulched these things pretty heavily, but I'm going to keep an eye on it and just see what happens. Others might, too, really.
Yeah. Well, and just remember, with certain things that are borderline like that, if something is amiss in the spring, that could in fact be what it was.
Exactly.
So it's not necessarily
was,
you did anything wrong. It's just going to happen from time to time.
Thought they wish you stay. What's up?
Well, speaking of the cold snap, we've been burning lots of fires in the fireplace, you know, for warmth, because we have a buck stove, so it's pretty efficient. But we had a Chinese chestnut that died in a fence row where other trees had lost limbs from the ice storm.
Okay, yeah.
And that's kind of our little area to go collect kindling, right? So I was reading up on what kind of wood is good for the fireplace.
Uh-oh.
And one of the types of wood that is absolutely not good for the fireplace is chestnut. Did you know that? It makes beautiful furniture, right? But it's terrible in the fireplace.
I had no idea.
So we built a couple of fires over the course of a couple of days, and I used this chestnut small twigs kindling. Bob, it was terrible. I mean, literally, thank goodness for the fat wood that we had, because we had, I mean, it literally just would not light.
I'll be darned. I wonder why.
I don't know. I mean, and it wasn't necessarily like smoky or hissy, like a high content of water in it. Do you know what I mean? They were dead. I mean, it was really dry because the tree had died, in fact. I was just so surprised.
It's just maybe too classy to burn.
Well, we didn't save any big logs, you know, for heat generation, whatever, but I thought surely I could use it as kindling. So, chestnuts do not make good trees for firewood.
But they will roast on an open fire.
They will roast on an open fire, exactly. There you go. Maybe that's why. Right. Too much competition there. All right, so yeah, no chestnut for the fireplace for us. But hey, how about a good book by the fireplace? And I think we've got one here with To See Every Bird on Earth.
Yeah, it is, and you will see birds and chestnut trees, of course, too, and many other places. And a man named Dan Capel is the author of To See Every Bird on Earth, A Father, A Son, A Lifelong Obsession. And Dan writes about his dad, Richard, who spent 50 years collecting over 7,000 bird species from around the world. To give some perspective, there are about 9,600 known species. 250 people have seen 5,000. 100 people have seen 6,000. 12 people have seen 7,000. And 2 people have seen 8,000. Dan knows all about that. Welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Great. To See Every Bird on Earth is a very personal story. Why tackle something so personal and kind of give our listeners an idea of the overview of To See Every Bird on Earth and what it means to you as, you know, father and son?
Well, the reason I tackled it, it wasn't initially by choice. I was asked by a magazine. I write for Audubon magazine, and they knew about my dad, and they asked me to go with him when he was approaching 7,000. And I wanted to, but I didn't expect it would lead to this sort of book, which is not just about that particular event, as the article was, but about his whole life and our life together and the way he chose birds over family and career. But we did become closer on that trip, and we had that great moment of celebration when we saw the 7,000th bird. So it became pretty logical to me as I explored my relationship with him and helped sort of together to make it better, that it was, there was a book in it. And actually the book was part of that process of making it better, because it involved hours and hours of us talking about things that we'd never talked about.
The underlying story, I guess, is the big list, over 7,000 species. Give us an idea of what it means to be a big lister and sort of the obsession that's involved in being a big lister and how that translates to your dad.
Sure. I mean, what I say in the book, and it's really true, is the list is everything. You can't see 7,000 birds without it becoming your whole life. You really have to give up almost everything else you've got, because it is impossible to do that otherwise. And I like to talk about how you have to travel to many countries more than once, you have to spend a lot of money, and you really have to spend a lot of time, even at home, studying your list, figuring out what your targets are, where you need to go, how you're going to do it. And I think people do it a lot of times because they're running away from things. Mm-hmm. My father was running away from a life he really didn't want to have, and he was running towards a childhood dream when he was a prodigy bird watcher and was kind of suppressed in doing that. There was another birder, one of the few who's seen more than 8,000, Phoebe Snetzinger, who had been diagnosed with cancer, and she was given 6 months to live. She had 4 recurrences, lived 30 years, and told me that she felt she would die if she stopped birding.
Okay.
And she, in fact, was killed on a birding trip in a car accident.
Wow. What's the history of birding in America? It's one of the biggest pastimes, or, you know, that's what they say. It's becoming increasingly popular in today's society. But what was bird watching like, you know, back when your dad started or even before?
Well, you know, the bird watching as we know it began in just before World War I. What that means is with binoculars instead of guns. People used to shoot birds and collect them. And the binocular really, it has to do with a growing amount of, you know, urbanism in society. You can't shoot birds in Central Park in New York. So people started to look for other ways. A lot of things came together. The development of high-quality optics, which was a result of German innovation during World War I, actually. The urbanization, people wanting to connect with nature when they were in cities, and it becoming a hobby and a sport almost. And people would contest bird watching. They would try and see as many as they could in 24 hours. And this is all, you know, you can see this is part of city life in a way, as much as country life. It's kind of heavy in action, or it was back then. It involves expensive
right.
equipment. So I think it's not so much a country sport as a city sport, although now it's become, you know, countrywide.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dan, I think any child will envy you the experience you had here, good and bad, of getting to know your father and or mother that well, and comes out so well in the book. What was it like for him at age 12. You talked about in the book his first birding experience and how he got hooked in that situation.
I mean, this was in Queens, New York, where I grew up too, and unlike Queens now, which is, you know, just houses laid out across many square miles, it was still very wooded. There were farms and countryside, and it was the Queens of Walt Whitman. He wrote about that quite a bit, and flowing brooks and things like that. And my dad had a woods near his house, and he used to ride his bike there, and he and a friend used to climb trees and look for bird eggs. And he got so interested in one bird that he went to a local library and then ultimately to a birding club to find out what it was. And the birding club welcomed him, and he found that he had a really good talent for spotting birds. And he was one of the youngest birders ever to be allowed into their 24-hour competitions. And that was his obsession, just took off from there.
Well, had it been butterflies, do you think it would have been the same? Why birds?
Well, I often say, people ask me why birds, and one of the reasons is birds are really easy to count. There's just enough of them.
Okay.
There's not, you know, there's thousands, tens of thousands of species of butterflies, which my dad is now counting, by the way. But birds are easy to handle. You know, there's maybe 300 birds in the state of New York. That's doable, even for a 12-year-old.
Mm-hmm. So how did his obsession, I guess, sort of galvanize, you know, it once it's entertainment, then it becomes something a little bit more significant as the years go on. What were some of the benchmarks, I guess, in his obsession?
Well, I think the big thing was that he was forbidden from doing it. My grandparents were very old world. They thought that being a birder was like, I don't know, like being an actor or something crazy.
Right.
They really didn't approve, and they forbid him. And my dad was a very dutiful son, and so he suppressed this desire. He didn't want it to be a hobby. He wanted it to be his career. And when he got married, it was the same thing. He decided, well, I'm going to be a husband and a parent. When he was drafted to Europe in the 60s, he was in the Army, and my mom was kind of more of a hippie, I guess. And they grew apart, and the more they grew apart, the more birds became his refuge. Mm-hmm. And by the time he came back from Europe in 1969, birds had really become everything to him. He had allowed his obsession, his desire as a child, you know, suppressed for 20, 25 years. It burst out in a way that was sort of uncontrollable, and that's how he started and decided that a life alone would be more satisfactory, or a life alone with birds, than a life with family and friends.
Yeah. You know, because when I was reading the personal side of the story and that component, you have to wonder what comes first. It's like, is he, as you said, his obsession grew because he was running away from things. So do the birds come first and then the problems, or do the problems come first so you run to the birds?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a really good question. And I think it was his unusual talent with the birds. I mean, it's very hard. Even now, you know, he's older now and his hearing and sight are not as good, but he can identify a bird, you know, that's 100 yards away in the bush.
Uh-huh.
He's very good, and I think it grows out of his talent and the way his talent was never nurtured or realized. I mean, he's a very obsessive person. He counts everything. And that, you combine the personality trait with the talent and the fact that his life was disappointing personally,
right.
I think, with the divorce, and that's where the big obsession comes out.
Yeah,
Dan, when I was a kid, I worked on a dairy farm, and I could tell 100 Holstein cows apart. That's still a long way from telling 7,000 birds apart. Just what's the materials required, the books and the work, to be able to identify these little subtle differences in sounds and feathers?
Right. You have to, I mean, the first thing you have to do is study. So when you're going off to Brazil, the top listers will make a list of target birds. They do it in various ways, but basically they'll list the birds that they're very likely to see that are common, then ones that are less common, and then ones that are uncommon. And they'll study these particular birds. So it's not like you have to know all 7,000 at once. You have to know 100, 150 for each part of the trip. And you're continuing to study. Now, you go birding with other birders, usually, and sometimes with an ornithologist guide, so you combine your strength and your knowledge.
Okay.
And it's not easy by any means. A lot of the birders on these trips can't do the identifications, and they rely on people like my dad to to confirm everything. Mm-hmm. But that's how you do it in pieces.
So what are the rules for the big listers, at least? I mean, your dad's considered a big lister. Maybe we should sort of kind of define that term as well. I mean, these are people that are serious about counting and listing birds.
Yeah.
So I would imagine that not just anybody can sort of waltz into the big listers club, so to speak, and hand over a list and say, I've seen all these birds. I mean, what's the proof?
Right. I mean, that's the number one question everybody asks. And the proof is really, you know, a form of peer pressure coupled with a harsh punishment. if you're going to see these kinds of birds, you're going to know your other 20 competitors or fellow big listers.
Uh-huh.
You're going to actually have traveled with them because it's just more economical that way, and they go on these trips together. And so very quickly, you gain your merit points, and you gain trust.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you lie, and it's not hard to catch a lie because you have to lie about birds that aren't in the places that they're supposed to be. And how many times can you get, you know, a rare bird? I mean, everyone gets a few, but if you have to lie by 200 or 300 birds to really beat out a competitor. And how many times can you do that before people are suspicious?
Mm-hmm.
And so 200 birds that are out of place that no one else has seen you see, and basically you're convicted.
People just know it's impossible. Yeah.
You're banished forever, and your name cannot be spoken. And I know of a couple of birders who've had that happen, and the bird big listers won't even talk about them to me. I mean, I have to hunt them down.
Yeah. Another thing that you did that was pretty cool in the book, I thought, there's a collection of somebody, and now I can't remember his name, but somebody who has a collection of stamps, a stamp collector, but it's the largest stamp collection with birds on them, right? So
yeah.
So you've used these stamps in the different chapters of your book, and they represent birds that were kind of benchmark birds for your father listing. What are some of the most significant finds, I guess, for your dad that might have been, as you say, a couple of them are unusual or sort of out of place, but you wouldn't have more than 100 unusual or out of place. What are some of the big ones for your dad?
Well, I like to tell this story, and it's also an illustration of his intenseness. It was a gull that was from the Arctic, and it appeared on a pier off in Portland, Maine. He was about 6-7 hour drive from there, so maybe more. So he decided he hadn't seen this bird. It was one of the few he needed to close out his North American list. Mm-hmm. In other words, to have seen every bird on the continent. So he heard about it. He got in his car, drove the 6 or 7 hours, stopped at the pier. The bird was there. He took a 5-minute look at it, got back in his car,
and went home.
And drove home.
Wow. You had said that your dad at one point said that he didn't even really like birds. So the question is, what is the fascination then? And maybe it goes back to what you said before, too, is that birds are doable. You know, you can count them, whether it's, you know, just in your backyard or North America or the rest of the world. It's somehow doable still as a list. But what's the fascination if you don't even really care about the bird? It's just the list.
It's the counting, and it's also that people are familiar with it. I mean, if you're a plane spotter, and I'm working on a story about that right now, nobody really knows about you. You know, if they see a crowd of people hanging out at LA airport, nobody knows that they're obsessive plane spotters. But everybody likes birds. Everyone knows what a robin looks like, a cardinal, a bluebird. And so it's kind of like, you know, when we were kids, maybe we played softball at, you know, the rank amateur level and looked up at the Major League Baseball players. I think it's the same thing. He was able to be a major leaguer in this.
Yeah.
And it didn't mean liking birds. It meant, like I said, exploiting his particular gift.
Mm-hmm. But Dan, for all his obsession, there were years when he found no birds for different reasons. What was that like for you growing up with this man? Could you tell his moods by the birds he was counting?
Well, yeah, I wouldn't say that he was in a bad mood when he didn't see a lot of birds. I think he was, but I didn't detect it as a child. But I could definitely tell that he was elated when he was seeing birds. Mm-hmm. And it gave me a very mixed feeling. I didn't really share that elation, and neither did my brother, because he didn't share it. He's not very... I say in the book that my dad was looking out the telescope and not at me and my brother, and that was really true. My childhood memories of our vacations are of him standing there looking through the telescope and my brother and I kicking the gravel and having to be absolutely quiet, waiting to see what to do. So, you know, and that's not necessarily true of all the big listers. Some of them actually do share with their peers. But my dad, again, it's a solitary activity, so it was really hard. We never uh, we I never went to Disneyland as a kid.
Yeah.
It was out of the question.
Yeah. Could you tell, too, growing up at all, it seemed like he made a concerted effort to arrange his lifestyle so that he could bird later on. But could you tell that he made choices about lifestyle, jobs, what was going to be done based on how birding was going to fit into it?
Like, not until I was much older.
Uh-huh.
I, growing up, that's what people did on vacations.
Right.
You know, that's what, when my parents were divorced, that's what kids did with their dads on their custodial weekends. They went to the park and looked at birds, and like I said, that, you hung around kicking the gravel. That's what I thought everybody did on the weekend.
But you never got into birding yourself.
Never did, no. I mean, I'm really interested in the outdoors. I write for a lot of outdoors magazines. I love nature. But birds have never really appealed to me in that way. And I've tried to develop, you know, even an amateur's talent, though I guess I have one in terms of basic identification skills. But I have to say, I'm more interested in the birders than the birds.
Mm-hmm.
So how did your dad kind of arrange his life later in terms of being able to go out and actively pursue the big list?
Right. Well, first, I mean, he arranged his life in every aspect. He moved to a smaller town, and that was, he was a doctor, and that was because there he was able to work as a doctor in a local emergency room that didn't get any traffic. So he was able to, you know, it was a small place. He made just enough money to fund his birding trips. He would arrange his own schedule. He worked his way up to manager of the emergency room, and he needed to. So he could arrange the schedule so he would work these sort of 2-week intense periods and then have 4 weeks off.
Yeah.
And those 4 weeks were dedicated to birding. So he would have his schedule planned 2 years in advance. He'd know where he was going to go. He'd begin studying, and he knew exactly what he would see in advance. He was able to tell me 2 years earlier when he was likely to see 7,000, though he hedged it a little bit. And so he completely arranged his life to be able to see birds. He sort of short-circuited a career. He short-circuited his time because even during those 2 or 3 weeks when he was at home, he was working all the time. So, nobody was able to maintain a social relationship with him. So really, birds were everything all the time.
Dan, your book builds to that 7,000th bird, and you were with him. Did your feelings change at all? Tell us about that experience and how you felt about him as compared to before when you were a kid.
Yeah, you know, my feelings had begun to change a few years earlier, partially because I was growing up and maybe he was mellowing out. And I was in my late 30s by the time the 7,000th came. But the 7,000th was a real watershed moment. It was the moment I realized how good he was at that and how much joy he felt at seeing this bird. It wasn't joy that was expressed, but in such a much of a way, but I could see it and I could feel it. And it made me think, yeah, this is a guy who's flawed, who's not really very good at being social, who probably wasn't the greatest father in the world in a traditional sense, but he was still my father, and he was still somebody who I wanted to be close to, and he was still great at something, and I felt proud. And I realized, as I say in the book, that I had to come to him through birds. It was the only way. And once I embraced that, it wasn't that hard a barrier to breach.
Mm-hmm. Terrific.
So were you finally able to answer that one question you asked of what it all means? What does the counting and the listing of birds really mean in the human scheme of things?
Yeah, I think it's an attempt from people whose lives have been disordered or chaotic or disappointing. It's a real attempt to organize nature. And birds are sort of an organizing feature of nature. You know, we know about the canaries in the coal mines. We know about the spotted owls, and that birds are indicator species. So seeing all the birds all over the world is really a way of creating your own index of everything else. And that's birds in city parks and birds in the Amazon. It doesn't make a difference where they are. So I think it really appeals to people who have a sense of needing to do that and don't know any other way. They're not able to master the world by mastering their family relationships, for example. It's a strange and very ambitious and very isolating way to really draw your own map of everything.
Wow.
Dan, thank you so much. We appreciate your time. It's a great story.
Absolutely.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
Dan Capel is the author of To See Every Bird on Earth, A Father, A Son, A Lifelong Obsession. If you would like more information, please visit our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up after the break, we meet up with Tracy Williams at Louisville's Green Building. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill.
And we are in downtown Louisville on location.
We are.
At a very exciting place, in fact. This area is now being referred to as New Lou, right?
Works for me, yeah.
Yeah, Bob's sort of scratching his head.
I never made the old Lou part.
You may be the old.
I'm the old Lou guy.
I'll bring you up to date, okay?
Okay, kiddo.
But we are on East Market, and as I said, redefining itself here as the Louisville Arts District. It's dubbed New Lou.
I believe you.
And one of the centerpieces in this area has become the LEEDS certified green building that's been renovated by Augusta and Gil Holland. The building has renewable energy systems, natural lighting, a green roof, and a green wall. The vertical garden or the green wall is where Tracy Williams comes in, and Tracy's hosting us here at the green building today to talk about the green wall that she designed and installed. The green wall, I don't think, or just calling it a green wall, Tracy, doesn't do it quite the justice that it deserves, I think, because it's a little bit more than that in terms of efficiency and artistry and all of that. So what are you trying to do personally by being involved in these sorts of projects and the green wall here?
Hi, Janine. Hi, Bob. Yes, there's a lot in a name. And what could be a green wall could also be called a bio wall, a vertical gardening, or what I like is moss growing on a wall. Mm-hmm. That's my favorite. So yeah. That's really what attracted me most to the project,
yeah,
was the idea of bringing plants to an eye level. So there are a lot of things and a lot of benefits of a green wall in terms of temperature reduction, and we can talk about those things. But for me, what intrigues me the most is just the delight of having plants brought up to eye level,
right,
and letting people really associate with them.
Looking at them like you would a piece of art.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Yes.
So, well, let's talk a little bit about the history of green walls, and probably I would imagine within that there are categories and ways that you can look at them that are very distinct.
Yes, absolutely. Green walls really go back for as long as there have been plants, they've been growing on unlikely surfaces. Mm-hmm. The Vikings have a long history of sod walls. The American plains had sod homes, you know, all scattered across. And there have been a lot of people through the generations who have done a lot of interesting work growing vertically. At the turn of the century, two very famous English gardeners, William Robinson and Gertrude Jekyll, were both planting green walls. Usually it was a dry stack wall or using vines where they coated the surfaces. And really what happened is modernism tended to wipe away the greenery in our cities because the slick surfaces are less suitable for plants to grow on. So there's been a long, long history of it, and really plants are very opportunistic. It's just a matter of finding the right situation, and I'm sure everyone's seen a tree growing out of a side of a building where the debris hasn't been disturbed and in gutters. So it's really just a matter of creating the medium for plants to grow as they naturally want to.
Sure, weeds grow in the cracks of pavements all the time.
Exactly,
right?
Yes.
And I admire trees growing out of bridge abutments and stuff. It's really kind of cool.
I do,
well,
too.
Tracy, give us a sense of your background and what brought you to this project and what your goals were when you came here.
Well, I got into the project when I was commissioned by Gil and Augusta to do the greening of the green building, including the roof and the outdoor landscaping. And I really approached the situation as a way of trying to eliminate some of the problems with the existing systems. I knew I didn't want a soil-based system because it's heavy, and eventually, because of the soil sloughing out of these modules that they planted in, I wanted something that was an inorganic medium, and I also very much wanted a modular system as opposed to a built-in-place system where the entire wall is covered and decided on, the dimensions are decided on at the beginning. The first thing I had to address was how do you contain the growing medium? And my inspiration was looking outside of my window last winter and seeing a suet feeder that we hang up for the birds, and the idea of a very simple, very thin cage. So I went to a local company, gave them a suet feeder, and said, please build me a bigger one of these. At that point, my system is actually adaptable to soil if someone wants it. So my first experiments, I sewed a sleeve of basically weed barrier or root barrier material, and I filled it with soil. What I planted in the soil worked really well, but in looking for a lighter solution, I realized that a hydroponic medium was perfect because it's got a lot of oxygen pockets that allow the roots to do very, very well because, as you probably know, roots tend to suffocate in a very dense medium. So this is very free draining. And as soon as I put it up vertically, I did realize that because it's so free draining, having a good integrated irrigation system is a very important factor to the success of the wall.
Let's give our listeners, Tracy, a sense of the size of this thing so they have a picture in their mind of what we're talking about. It's about 450 square feet, maybe 15 by 30 feet. There's 800 plants now, 32 different species growing on that wall. So take it from there and explain how you did all this.
Well, I actually started by planting the cages and laying them down horizontally on the floor because I thought that they would need a period of time to root in so that they wouldn't be loose when I put them up. But I realized, you know, a lot of this is experimenting. I realized as I went that I could have hung it immediately. So the medium is a white hydroponic medium inside this cage. I put slits in, determined by the size of the plant at maturity. And I would just put the small root ball. The root balls came in different sizes. Anyone who's grown plugs before knows they come in 32, 50, and 72. So a lot of them came in all those different sizes. And I would just plug the plug in. And almost immediately, I started seeing roots rooting into the medium.
There's 32 different kind of plants there. What kind are they? Talk about the species and so forth.
This is what's so exciting. The palette of plants I'm just really in love with. They typically shade varieties because what's interesting about this situation is that the green wall is under a cover in an open-air courtyard. So while it doesn't get any rainfall on it, it is still outdoors, and I chose a palette of plants that was very adapted to deep shade, and I tried to get as many evergreen plants as possible. So I have a lot of carex, a lot of heuchera, a lot of ferns, everything from Cerasta stigma to Hakona chloe to, the list goes on. And what I really tried to keep in mind in planting is I wanted it to feel like a tide pool that I remember looking at as a child when the water would drift in and the seaweed would swirl and sway. I wanted to get a very organic feeling, and I had the opportunity to do a very modern interpretation, but I really wanted the wall to relate as a whole, like you said, Janine, more like a framed piece of art, and I wanted it to have a lot of movement and texture and color. So I did spend a lot of time really deciding where my drifts of color would be and to try and plant things in a way that would really bring out the highlights of each individual plant.
Mm-hmm. So for now, when we look at it, because it's not, you know, I think some people think that a green wall is supposed to be literally just, you know, a living wall, nothing else. But when we look at it, because it was just planted this June, there's still a lot of white space. So it's almost like a grid with, white within the lines of the...
Like graph paper.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, little plants sticking out. And some people would say, hey, wait a minute, that doesn't look quite right because it's not all covered in green. So, you know, what do you say to those sorts of arguments in terms of what's there?
Patience.
There you go.
It'll take a little bit of time. Mm-hmm. That is something that anyone who gardens has to get over, especially when they work with clients, is the fact that certain plants do take a while to mature. Mm-hmm. And I find this awkward adolescent stage quite lovely because I know that very soon it is going to be a very solid mass, and I'm really interested in also introducing spores of mosses and baby ferns, and I'm going to also be doing annual planting and edibles in the spring. Mm-hmm. And I'm also very interested in experimenting with bulbs. So what I bring to residential design, which is multi-seasonal interest, I'm really wanting to capture that in this wall so that the wall can progress and grow through the seasons and mm-hmm. be just as interesting in winter as it is in spring or summer.
So one of the wintertime concerns would be hardiness issues. You know, we don't leave containers of plants out, you know, to freeze, and it's been pretty cold here lately. Are there techniques that you've employed here to make sure that the wall is frost hardy?
No, I believe in tough love with plants.
Okay.
I did try to select things that were very, very hardy. So just about everything has got a hardiness rating that should be mm-hmm. fine. But Janine, that's a really good point. When people do plant on walls, they have to realize that the wind chill in an exposed situation, and while this is in an indoor courtyard, they're significant drafts of cold air, and typically on a side of a building, the air temperature could be many, many degrees lower. So that is a very important consideration.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take it one step further then in terms of what the wall may be doing for the building as opposed to what the building's doing for the green wall. Talk about the benefits of some of these living walls. You know, what's the science of it?
Yes, that's something that really does interest me quite a bit, because what we typically find is that all the benefits that come along with a green roof are very much the same as what you would get on a green wall. But what really intrigues me is that in urban situations, we typically have so many vertical surfaces, more vertical surfaces than horizontal surfaces. So the figures are still being worked out, but it really does indicate that the ambient air temperatures are going to be greatly reduced in the summertime by shading the building. You know, thermal insulation, the heat builds up in cities and it's stored in the building. But because the plants stay close to the ambient air temperature, they cool the building because of their evapotranspiration and the direct shading of the walls. And by reducing the temperature immediately outside the building by 10 degrees Fahrenheit, you reduce the amount of energy required for air conditioning by 50 to 70%. And that's by planting on the southern and the western walls. So there really is an opportunity for significant energy savings. And it also shields the building surfaces from ultraviolet light, which also means that, yeah, some of your surfaces could actually last longer because they are being shaded and protected. What's also interesting is the acoustic control that green walls offer in cities where it's very noisy from cars, trucks, aeroplanes, and by the noise of people, the reduction in noise levels is actually quite significant. And what really I love is the opportunity to provide habitat for really a multitude of bat, insect, and bird species. So in turn, it's increasing the biodiversity in our cities. I'd say that there's a really strong case for fire resistance. And there's also an opportunity for, you know, we talk about summer cooling, but there's also the opportunity to save winter heating costs by planting on the north sides of walls. So by reducing the wind chill by 75%, you can reduce the heating demand by up to 25%.
It's like using insulated curtains.
Exactly. And that's something that I've really been thinking about doing is actually adapting the system to be free strung, to be able to be strung between buildings to act as privacy and insulation curtains as well. So it's great that you mentioned the word curtains, because I'm really thinking of adapting this to become a lot more flexible, where you could wrap around things and to be able to pull a curtain between a building that could be planted on both sides. And I'm so intrigued by the idea of food production in cities where we have poison soil. So the options for people to plant in a city and really produce a significant amount of food, I think, is actually quite astounding. And I've been experimenting with edible panels, and they've been working out really well for lettuces. All the herbs do remarkably well. Vegetables like tomatoes, etc., they've all been doing wonderfully.
How do you deal with fertilizing something like this? How do you vary what you put in there, and what percent do you use?
Yeah, Bob, that's interesting, because you put your finger on really the integral part. Because this is a hydroponic medium, there is no built-in fertility in the soil, so it's imperative that you introduce fertilizer. And my system, I've intentionally left it exposed, so if anyone wants to come down to the green building at 732 Market Street, you can walk into the back courtyard and take a look. And I've left the irrigation exposed so that you can see it's a very simple flow reduction on a timer. And I've got a PVC pipe running vertically, and I've just strung horizontal spans of drip tape. And it's a very flexible and pressure self-regulating tape. So you're getting an even distribution of water and fertilizer down the medium.
Can people come anytime and see this wall?
Yes, during business hours, absolutely.
So at this point, as we said, it was planted in June. Have you figured out what mistakes might have been made that, you know, can help improve your system? And are there plans to try to get some of these installed, you know, in other places around Louisville?
I'd very much like that, because really I think the sky's the limit. And the fact that the system is so lightweight, my early experiments really seem to show that this is at least half as heavy as some of the other modular systems out there. So it offers a much greater potential for going a lot taller. But I really want to stress that I wanted to find a system that would be very easy for homeowners as well to grow five panels or a single lettuce panel in addition to the opportunities that we have in a city to cover up the side of a building.
Because each panel is about how big?
It's about 20 by 20 and only about 2 inches thick. So it's actually a very thin panel. Mm-hmm. But it's,
I could get a couple and hang them somewhere. If I lived in the city, I actually don't need them. But that's what I mean. Like that could
Absolutely.
Be like a patio garden sort of thing for all kinds of people. So the options in terms of small to big,
Absolutely.
You know, are there.
And it's also
you can
very,
keep adding if you want.
Yes, and it's also very adaptable to indoor gardens as well.
Could this ever work on bigger plants like cabbages and cherry tomatoes? And what's the limit here?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I have not found limits because really, as long as the plant is secured, which it's doing itself in the medium, I've got actually very little doubt that I wouldn't be able to support the growth of much larger shrubs. In fact, some of the other systems out there have got really quite significantly large plants growing in them. So as long as they're getting the nutrients to support the
right.
size of the plants, I really don't see a limit.
Right. So as long as you keep the water on them and, I mean, basically we're controlling their environment, so we have to provide them with what they need, and as long as you do that, then it should not fail.
Exactly.
And once your initial cost is paid, at some point it's going to be cost effective, I would think. 2-3 years down the road, it'd be as cheap as anything else.
I agree, Bob. And what's interesting is that people doing green roofs have found out that green roofs typically last a lot longer than an open roof because really it's protecting the building substructure and roofing system from the ultraviolet and from wear and tear. So I do expect that there's going to be a greater cost effectiveness as this develops.
Sounds fabulous. No, people should definitely come down and take a look. If nothing else, it's like a large version of a series of suet feeders filled, stuffed with like pillow stuffing or whatever,
yeah.
and then plants sticking out of it. I mean, I know it's much more complicated than that, but that's visually what the concept is. So if you want to get one panel, two panels, or 400 panels, you can probably get it done here with your new system. Are you going to try to kind of push this as in a proprietary sort of way as, you know, Tracy Williams copyrighted trademarked system for green walls?
Right now I'm just sort of selling and marketing the product under my business name, which
okay.
is Green Sleeves Design. And
okay.
I think the idea of green sleeves, you know, my first idea for my business name came from the fact that I don't believe in green thumbs. I think that people, by rolling up their sleeves and getting dirty, learn a craft. And that's all this is. This is just a craft that I've experimented with enough that it's sort of I'm developing it as I go along. And the idea of green sleeving a building and covering a building and a vertical surface in a green sleeve actually seemed to be quite appropriate.
It is indeed. Thank you, Tracy.
Thank you, Janine and Bob, so much.
Thank you. Tracy Williams is a local garden designer and gardener. You can see Tracy's green wall at the Green Building located on 732 East Market in downtown Louisville. For more information on the Green Building or Tracy Williams, please see our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and another chapter in Bob's fabulous plant stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill.
And we've got a couple of questions to address.
Yeah, we do.
This one's from Bill. He writes that they have a large triangular yard that's well-treed.
like a dog.
No kidding. There's a mature tulip poplar, hemlocks, a circle of sweet bay magnolias, pines, maple ash. It does indeed sound it's well-treed. But they acquired a little puppy, a polite little puppy dog, they say. And as a consequence, they needed a fence. So they have a 200 linear feet fence, green vinyl, welded wire, and they're interested in growing some vines on this fence. They're happy with anything that's rustic. Also, a little color and fragrance mm-hmm. would be nice. What are our suggestions?
Yeah, I see a kind of a mix in there. It'd be kind of fun. I like bignonia or cross vine. It's got a long orange flower, and the hummingbirds mm-hmm. like it. And my favorite vine really is Moonglow Climbing Hydrangea, which has an incredible mm-hmm. kind of bluish-gray leaf. The flowers are really nice, too, but that'll do better in the shade. Then our forms of honeysuckle that are not as invasive as the others, they're more domesticated honeysuckle, can have some fragrance for them. Then there's one called Dutchman's Pipe, which is a really cool leaf.
Mm-hmm.
Just a leaf like a, just like a shingles on a roof almost.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be kind of fun to have. How about Miss Wishy?
Yeah.
What do you think?
And because it's a chain link fence, he can do anything that's going to be twining.
Oh, yeah.
Two really vigorous vines that can cover pretty quickly come to mind. Sweet Autumn Clematis.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And it can tolerate shade. It blooms pretty prolifically later in the summer, and it's very fragrant. And then the fleece vine, which can be kind of aggressive,
yeah.
Quite frankly.
Oh, yeah.
But it's aggression sometimes serves its purpose, right?
Yeah.
And I think those two kind of have a rustic feel to them. One of my favorites, too, is the crossvine, the bignonia.
Yeah.
You have to be patient the first couple of years when you plant that. It doesn't seem to do much.
No.
And then it takes off.
Yeah.
So, you know, mixing some of those things together may not be a bad idea. But
yeah, mine's even 40 feet up the tree now.
Yeah,
so it's,
exactly.
It's real happy.
It is real happy.
Question from Marlene. Kind of a fun question, too. This fall, I took my geraniums in early, warmed it up, and put them back until it got cold in earnest. They are sitting in front of my balcony doors, blooming like crazy. This was a couple weeks ago, I'm sure. This is the first time they have bloomed in the winter. What do you think happened?
So she's brought them in, and they're sitting in front of her balcony doors.
Yep.
So I would say, or I'd have to ask the question, is this the first time she's kept her geraniums in a sunny location inside?
Oh,
because
yeah.
Honestly, the geranium, any geranium can kind of continue to produce bloom, look
right.
good, as long as you provide it with sun, fertilizer, and water, right?
Exactly.
So it doesn't really matter if it's summertime or wintertime, just as long as it's warm wherever the geranium is. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
So I think your sunny location may be working to your geranium's advantage this year.
Watch, geranium will bloom.
Indeed it will. It
certainly will. If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 502-814-8246.
All right, Bob, it's Plant Story. What do you got this week?
I've taken a page from the Wishy Playbook.
All right.
I'm going to match the topic of my plant story to a topic today.
Excellent.
The wallflower.
Relevancy.
Right, more or less.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah. The wallflower. You've heard of the wallflower.
Double entendre, perhaps, right?
Maybe, yeah, triple. And easy to spell, anyway. The wallflower's got a great, fun history. It's got its name because it grew in cracks of old walls,
okay.
Stone paths, quarries, that kind
Not
of stuff.
Not because it's shy.
We'll get to that in a little bit here. Its first botanical use was recorded in 1578, so it's been around for a while. But its more common use today, as you mentioned, it refers to a shy man or woman who sits alone at a dance by the wall, was first used in an 1820 book by Mrs. Campbell Praed, P-R-A-E-D,
huh.
In a book entitled The Country Ball.
Hmm.
Didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
She was an Australian native who later moved to England and hung out with the likes of Rudyard Kipling,
cool.
Oscar Wilde, and Bram Stoker.
Sounds good.
And you know what he did.
I'm sure she wasn't a wallflower.
Nor was Dracula. It's basically an herb in the mustard family. There's
mm-hmm.
a bunch of species from all over the world. We've pretty much settled on one genus here, the Ericium,
mm-hmm.
which is cool. It's a Greek word meaning to help or to save from the medicinal properties.
Cool.
Because it helps or saves people. Native to Southern Europe, comes in all sorts of colors, yellow, orange, brown, red, and purple. It needs good sun, good drainage. Grows from 3 feet to 3 inches tall, can be fragrant, and butterflies like them. And they're sort of fussy. They don't like a lot of heat or humidity or cold. They're often treated as biannuals,
mm-hmm.
you know, for seed especially. The first year you get the leaves, the second mm-hmm. year you get the flower, the third year you get death. My favorite cultivar is one called Aunt May, 6 inches tall, and there's another one called Constant Cheer, which we all need this time of year. Comes with a poem. Here's the thought to which I have come. Have we mistreated the Ericium, a beautiful flower with fragrance fair, growing there on wall and stair. So sweet of scent, so fair to eye, and nothing quite about it shy. Yet one writer finds it inner power to greatly diminish this ancient flower, to weaken it so with a writer's trick, to give it qualities anthropomorphic. I say give it one more chance. Please ask the wallflower in your garden to dance.
Very good. All right. The wallflower. Sounds good. Grows out of walls and maybe a little shy from time
Tracy
to time.
Maybe Tracy Williams.
There you go. Thanks, Bob. That ends another edition of Homegrown. We hope that you'll join us again next week.
Homegrown was produced by that producer dynamo, Brad Yost, in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.